Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
A resolution against the referendum in Crimea fails in the UN Security Council. And Malaysia's prime minister says someone on the missing plane turned off communications. I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington. The UN Security Council has failed to adopt a resolution that would have urged countries not to recognize the results of tomorrow's referendum on Ukraine's Crimea region. Russia, as expected, voted against the measure, while China abstained. 13 other Security Council members voted in favor of the resolution. China's decision to decline to follow Russia and veto the measure could further indicate isolation for Moscow in its support of the Crimean referendum. Meanwhile, after 6 hours of meeting on Friday, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov failed to reach agreement on Ukraine's future. VOA State Department correspondent Scott Stearns reports from London.
It appears increasingly clear that Russia already has made its choice about Crimea. A senior State Department official traveling with Kerry said the secretary came to London to talk about a unified Ukraine, while Lavrov came empowered to talk only about a Ukraine without Crimea. Adding to those tensions are thousands more Russian troops near the Ukrainian border from maneuvers that Moscow says will continue for 2 weeks. A senior State Department official says Lavrov assured Kerry that those new Russian troops will not enter Ukraine. The foreign minister made similar assurances before Russian troops crossed the Crimean border following the collapse of the pro-Russian government in Kiev. Scott Stearns, VOA News, London.
Malaysia's prime minister says there is a high degree of certainty that someone deliberately shut off the communications and transponder on the missing Malaysia Airlines jet with 239 people on board. Prime Minister Najib Razak said at a news conference today, search efforts in the South China Sea are ending and officials are reassessing deployment of their assets.
We can say with a high degree of certainty that the aircraft communications addressing and reporting system was disabled just before the aircraft reached the east coast of Peninsula Malaysia.
The prime minister added that when Flight 370 stopped communicating with satellites, it was in one of two corridors. Mr. Razak said the search now enters a new phase and the disappearance of the aircraft was consistent with a deliberate action, that authorities are refocusing their investigations on the crew and the passengers, with all possibilities being considered.
Despite media reports that the plane was hijacked, I wish to be very clear. We are still investigating all possibilities as to what caused MH370 to deviate from its original flight path.
Flight 370 disappeared last Saturday. A Pakistani tribunal has taken 10 years off the 33-year sentence of a doctor who helped the U.S. spy agency find Osama bin Laden. Shaquille Afridi was convicted in 2012, not of working for the CIA, but on charges of giving money and providing medical treatment to Islamic militants. Afridi is believed to have been targeted by Pakistani authorities because of allegations that he ran a vaccination program to collect DNA and verify bin Laden's presence in the town of Abbottabad. In Syria, troops there have advanced on a major rebel-held town near the Lebanese border as the country's bloody conflict marks its third anniversary. State media and activists say soldiers supported by warplanes, artillery, and tanks entered the town of Yarmouk today. It is the second week of Oscar Pistorius' murder trial, and it was full of blood, tears, and riveting testimony. VOA's Anita Powell reports.
The 10th day of Oscar Pistorius' murder trial started in dramatic fashion, with graphic photos of the runner. The images were taken by police shortly after they arrived at his home to find he had shot dead his girlfriend, Reva Steenkamp, in the wee hours of Valentine's Day 2013. The photos of a red-eyed Pistorius, naked from the waist up and splattered with Steenkamp's blood, were a stark contrast to the suit-clad man who sat in the packed courtroom and averted his eyes from the screens showing his image. Earlier this week, Pistorius retched and vomited in court while listening to graphic testimony about Steenkamp's injuries from the shots. Anita Powell, VOA News, Pretoria, South Africa.
The injuries were particularly heavy because the type of bullet made to flatten and explode inside the human body. I'm Marty Johnson, VOA News, Washington. More news at voanews.com.
evening. This is Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. I'm Douglas Impuga.
And I'm Odette Fraser. Thanks for joining us.
He says he has asked that his group be immediately put in camps, then demobilized and helped to rejoin civilian life.
CAR plans to move Ante Balaka from the capital, Bangui.
No, I think Boko Haram has become a serious threat for Nigeria. The threat to national security, threat to territorial integrity, a threat to the political process in terms of the ongoing democratization process.
How serious is the threat by the Islamist militant group Boko Haram?
The nation needs a united front to refine the struggle and to demand true national leadership that can begin to address the multi-layered crisis facing this nation.
And we look at how opposition political parties are struggling in Zimbabwe. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The Central African Republic's government is considering a plan to persuade Ante Balaka militia fighters to leave the capital and return to their villages. But international peacekeeping chiefs are skeptical about a proposal that might leave them in charge of large camps full of combatants. For VOA, Nick Long reports from Bangui.
Both the Seleka rebels who overthrew the president last year and the anti-Balaka militias that drove back the Seleka are accused of massacring thousands of people and of widespread looting and destruction. At least 100,000 Muslims have fled the Western CAR in recent months as a result of sectarian violence led by the anti-Balaka. Some of the anti-Balaka in Bangui came from the provinces late last year, seeking revenge on the Seleka or perhaps just wanting to loot the capital. The government wants to help them go home. One government minister told VOA that anti-Balaka seeking to leave will need transportation and farm tools. And an anti-Balaka coordinator who advises the government said there is a plan to find a place where the anti-Balaka can gather before going home. Gilbert Kamizulai says he commands the anti-Balaka militia in southern Bangui. He says he has asked that his group be immediately put in camps, then demobilized and helped to rejoin civilian life. And he says they should receive amnesty. The papers are with the government, he says, but it's taking time and they find themselves still in the field. The plan will probably involve international aid donors. It will also likely involve the French and African Union peacekeeping missions to protect the demobilized militia. French Commander General Francisco Soriano said this week he has concerns about the idea of putting the anti-Balaka in camps. As for the anti-Balaka, he asks, who are they and who is their chief? He says he doesn't know. If people are to be put in camps or canton, says Soriano, there needs to be a clear chain of command and a chief who has authority over them. There is also the risk that a huge number of people could turn up at a camp and wait there for months and then decide not to leave after all. Some Seleka fighters have been cantoned in Bangui, but Soriano says that was possible because they have a chain of command and are identifiable. However, others in the international community are more sympathetic to the idea of a camp for the anti-Balaka. They include the interim UN humanitarian coordinator in the country, Kouassi Lazare Etienne, who wants the groups disarmed. Still, Etienne recognizes the difficulty with the plan. Normally, for disarmament to succeed, the armed group needs to be cantoned, he says, and the anti-Balaka are spread out all over the country. Such a plan is likely weeks, if not months, away from fruition. There are only about 2,000 French and 6,000 African peacekeepers in the country, although more European troops are due to arrive. And money has been slow to arrive for any of the projects meant to restore order in the CAR, where hundreds of thousands have been displaced. Nick Long for VOA News, Bangui.
Suspected Islamist militants launched a brazen daytime attack a Friday in the northeastern region, Nigerian city of Maiduguri. Witnesses say gunmen armed with explosives stormed the Giwa military barracks, setting off a fierce gun battle with soldiers. The attackers also set fire at homes in a residential area and opened fire on civilians. Although there was no immediate claim of responsibility, Maiduguri is the home city of the radical sect Boko Haram. David Zumeni is a senior research fellow, Conflict Prevention and Risk Analysis Division at the Institute for Security Studies. I reached him by phone in Pretoria, South Africa, to find out how serious a threat Boko Haram is to Nigeria.
No, I think Boko Haram has become a serious threat for Nigeria. The threat to national security, threat to territorial integrity, a threat to the political process in terms of the ongoing democratization process, and the threat to the economic growth that many institutions are projecting about Nigeria, and above all, threat to civilian populations who are simply massacred by a kind of orgy of violence unleashed by that movement.
Why do you think the Nigerian government and Nigerian forces have been almost unable to control the acts of Boko Haram?
I think it stems for me from the appreciation of the threat. I think from day one, Nigerian security forces have not really appreciated the threat the way it's supposed to be, and to design appropriate and coherent response strategy. Response was initially military in nature, which killed 800 of the groups and eliminated the head. But that was precisely the reason why we see a kind of mushrooming of different poles of violence, more or less radical, from radicals to moderate, that are now challenging the authority of the president. It has also taken a kind of a political dimension, because probably used as a political tool in the hand of some political actors to undermine the current administration. So all that considered, Nigeria has never really designed a comprehensive approach that was called for by various actors in the country to really confront Boko Haram.
There are those who consider Boko Haram more of not only as a Nigerian problem, not a threat to Nigeria alone, but to the region. Do you concur with that analysis?
No, definitely. I think Boko Haram is no longer a Nigerian problem, necessitating a domestic response that Nigeria always prided itself to be capable of offering. Boko Haram can kidnap in Cameroon, can harm somebody in Niger. They have developed a kind of regional support network that needs to be taken into consideration. And that's the reason why President Jonathan himself has called upon the neighbors to really join in terms of cooperation to tackle the problem, but also has called upon international partners, including France, to provide support for Nigeria's fight against Boko Haram, because the survival of Nigeria and the territorial integrity of Nigeria depends on how successful the counter-terrorist strategy that the government has put in place will be.
So far, in your opinion, that strategy doesn't seem to be succeeding to contain the group.
Absolutely. I think that strategy is faulty, because we start by looking at even the domestic initiative. The Nigerian security services are facing enormous challenges ranging from personal disputes, lack of cohesion, lack of vision, that have even posed the president to really sack some of the security, high-ranking security officers about a few weeks ago, and to replace them. And the recent appointment of General Aliu Gusau, that was perceived to be a very key appointment, a very, very positive development, is also facing its own challenges with the controversy about whether he will be able to have the collaborations of other key security actors in the country, or whether people will simply undermine his authority as it appears over the past 48 hours.
Lastly and briefly, given the nature of Boko Haram operations within Nigeria and in some neighboring countries, does the help from other countries like the United States, Britain, and most recently France, do you think they can help contain the group?
I think Nigeria really needs some order in the intelligence gathering sector, which is missing. Information gathering is a key element in terms of anticipating and preventing the actions. It doesn't seem to me that the intelligence, National Intelligence Agency in Nigeria today is up to the task. So the assistance that can come from the US, UK, or France need to be mainstreamed in the national this national strategy that will reinforce the local capacity to really face head on the challenge, particularly anticipating and acting before they can strike again.
David Zumeni, a senior research fellow, Conflict Prevention and Risk Analysis Division at the Institute for Security Studies in Pretoria.
The World Bank has launched consultations with development partners for a new Egypt strategy. The World Bank country director, Hartwig Schaefer, says that there are 24 projects totaling about $4.7 billion currently underway in Egypt. I reached him in Cairo to find out the bank's commitment to development in Egypt.
The country partnership strategy for the World Bank Group defines the relationship and the areas of intervention that the World Bank is undertaking in Egypt to support the development of Egypt and to improve the lives of the people. The previous strategy was an interim strategy note that was approved in mid-2012, and usually that runs for about a year and a year and a half. So that ended in December 2013, and we are still in a transition phase, but we expect that a new government will be in place by middle of this year. So we started working on this strategy now so that by the time it is ready, can vet it with the new government and then start execution of it. This is a process that usually it takes anywhere from 6 to 8 to 9 months of a year to get a strategy ready from the initial stage through the consultations until it is finalized.
Do you think that this is the right time to launch such an initiative?
Yes, I think absolutely, because the challenges that Egypt faces are going to be the same no matter what government is going to be in place. The issues are unemployment, especially getting jobs for the young and jobs for women, social inclusion, social justice, to make sure that everybody in the Egyptian society participates in the economic and political decision framework, and macroeconomic stability. So these issues will be with us now in March. They will be with us as challenges in June and in August and September. So at this stage, we are actually focusing on the diagnostic and the areas of emphasis, the challenges and what can be done.
How will the initiative be implemented?
It is a strategy or a strategic framework for the next 3 years. So what we are going to do now is we are going around the country. We are not just staying in Cairo. We are going around the country consulting different stakeholder groups. And these stakeholder groups include the government, civil society, academia, the private sector, development partners. And eventually when a parliament is put in place, they will also include parliamentarians to consult with them of how they see the challenges, how they see the solutions, and then where do they see the comparative advantage of the World Bank. And we pull all this together, and eventually it will then play itself out over the next 5 years or the next 4 years in terms of what are the projects that we would be supporting, what are the areas where we are going to support the policy dialogue, and what are the areas where we are going to provide technical assistance, and are there any areas where we need to provide analytical background and studies to help formulate policies.
So what are some of the other projects currently undertaken by the World Bank in Egypt, and how are those projects thriving with a seeming state of insecurity in the country at the moment?
We have a portfolio that is currently under implementation of 24 projects, and those 24 projects will continue into the new strategies, but some of those projects will come to an end and new projects will come in. And it's a total commitment of about $4.7 billion, and they're all and aligned with the World Bank's mission of eliminating poverty and boosting shared prosperity, or bringing about social justice and inclusion.
Where do you see Egypt in the next 2 to 5 years in terms of macroeconomic development?
I think Egypt has great potential, and I think everybody realizes that one of the top priorities is to bring about macroeconomic stability. The current fiscal deficit is not sustainable, largely driven by a huge share of the budget that is going to subsidies that are not reaching the poor. So one of the corrective measures that the government will have to take is to make sure that the subsidies are reaching the poor, to move from subsidies that are on commodities like fuel to subsidies that are really targeted to those who need them through cash transfer programs. This is something that this government will have to tackle. We would support them with the analysis and bring solutions and knowledge to the table here in Egypt. And I think then with a fiscal deficit that is more balanced in the range of 8 to 9% of GDP, then credit would be available for the private sector, and private sector investment, especially foreign direct investment, would pick up, and Egypt could have growth rates again of what they saw in 2008, 2009 of 5 to 6% per year.
The World Bank Egypt Country Director, Hartwig Schaefer, speaking with me from Cairo.
A court in France has delivered the country's first ever conviction for genocide, sentencing a former Rwandan soldier 25 years in prison. The Paris court found Pascal Simbakangwa guilty of genocide and complicit for crimes against humanity for his role in the 1994 massacre in Rwanda. During the trial, Simbakangwa denied any role in the killings of several hundred thousand ethnic Tutsis and moderate Hutus.
In Zimbabwe, last July's elections have come and gone, leaving disputed results and many unanswered questions. But what is not in question is that Zimbabwe's opposition political parties are in disarray with no sign of improvement on the ground as a countdown to the next crucial election in 2018 has already begun, especially with the succession issues dugging both ZANU-PF and the main opposition party, the Morgan Tsvangirai-led MDC. Thomas Tiripasi has more details from Harare.
President Robert Mugabe's ZANU-PF and the MDC have met in national elections several times, but the Revolutionary Party has always emerged victorious. In last year's elections, Mr. Mugabe traveled to all the country's 10 provinces seeking re-election and denouncing the two MDC formations. Despite the numerous rallies, Mr. Tsvangirai went on to lose the polls by a wide margin and claimed the elections were rigged in Mr. Mugabe's favor. Following his drubbing in the polls, Mr. Tsvangirai is now calling for a grand coalition of all democratic forces to increase the opposition's chances of winning in the next elections. There is growing consensus between the two formations of the MDC that all democratic forces should form a grand coalition ahead of the next elections due in 2018.
The nation needs a united front to refine the struggle and to demand true national leadership that can begin to address the multi-layered crisis facing this nation.
Former St. Mary's legislator Job Scala, who was leading a breakaway faction of the MDC, calling itself MDC 99, has since heeded Mr. Tsvangirai's call. Meanwhile, the MDC formation led by Professor Walsh Mengube, which has been refusing to talk with Tsvangirai, now says its doors are open for coalition talks, despite Mube having been previously quoted in the media as saying that he will never again work with Mr. Tsvangirai. The party's deputy national spokesperson, Kurawone Chiwai, told Studio 7 that the talks should be held in good faith.
Our door is still open for serious political organizations, people who are ready to serve this country. But we are not stopping. We are currently preparing for 2018 general elections. We are not stopping. We have strategic plans for 2018, and the ball is rolling.
But the newly formed National Constitutional Assembly Party says it will not be part of the negotiations for coalition talks. Mr. Tsvangirai said he would reach out to NCA leader Love Mohammed Duku, but NCA spokesman Madok Chivasa said the interim committee running the party has no mandate to enter into negotiations with Mr. Tsvangirai.
We read about it and we also hear about it, especially in the media. But as NCA, the new political party, is currently being led by the interim leadership, and that interim leadership was given a specific task at Congress. And that task is to ensure that we have membership in every ward Then we go to our first Congress where we're going to elect leadership. So what Mr. Tsvangirai is saying can only then be feasible when there is a leadership in the NCA.
Meanwhile, Chiwai says the culture of violence in the MDCT must come to a complete stop if a working relationship was to be mooted. The MDCT has been cautioned by its own cadres and embassies in Harare to deal with intra-party violence that was first reported before the 2005 split, but recently reared its ugly head when the party's deputy treasurer general, Elton Mangoma, was assaulted by party youths for asking Tsvangirai to resign and pave way for new leadership to steer the party ahead of the 2018 polls.
We have no plans to go to be paraded by Mr. Tsvangirai at Harvest House, and we are not at the moment taking Harvest House noisemakers seriously. We are a more serious political party with a serious political program for 2018. We are concentrating on winning 2018 national elections. In the event that like-minded Democrats come forward, our door is still open to engage pro-democratic forces.
But Mr. Tsvangirai said his party was not violent following Mangoma's attack at the party's Harvest House headquarters.
At the recent hearing, we were actually surprised when people took pictures of the crowd that was outside the Harvest House during that fracas. The video which was taken, there's actually a surprise that the person who actually hit Mangoma cannot be arrested, cannot be found. He's there in the video, the police know him.
Asked to comment on the state of opposition politics in the country, ZANU-PF spokesperson Rugare Gumbo told Studio 7 Zimbabwe needs a strong opposition to keep those in power in check so they can deliver. Reporting from Harare, this is Thomas Chiripasi.
Hello, I am Shaka Sali. Join me on Straight Talk Africa every Wednesday as we discuss topics of special interest to Africans, including politics, economic development, press freedom, health, social issues, and conflict resolution. Take your pick. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio.
Music Time in Africa offers splendid sounds from the continent that all humanity calls home. From the classics of yesteryear to the hot tracks of the moment. I offer you what you need. Free ear therapy and mind massage. Join me. I'm Heather Maxwell for Music Time in Africa. Every Saturday and Sunday at 0900, 2000 and 2100 UTC.
Happening Africa. This is Jackson Bunganyi in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 1730 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Can't AU, African Union, can't these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Employment rates are climbing, so definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
This is The Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa.
And still to come in the program, the Saturday Music Spot from our collection of music from the continent. Then we'll have a commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University.
It's now time for our Saturday Music Spot, so sit back and enjoy. Kabichi, we mwa galanti. Kabichi, o ange we mwa galamonge diwe mirembe takukani. Kabichi, mundo ko mwa galamonge diwe mirembe takukani. Si chaga la we mbamo sanze. Kali neva na nyumirwa, mbuze ke mirembe. Kali watenze mubita, na yari na ye mikwano. Asana yo spesis, simulunda, simutaiza. Sive manya kazanyo, era olibwa mbu. Watching my phantom, Muda Monti, Katika Richi Mwechari. Emulingiriza muwakabanga Kale wadolu mumbuza Unaye wasirika Sikaka ansa Esimuwe imba Simu soya soya Zesiri loya Hera oni wambuza Watching my panto, Muda Monti, Katika Richi Mwecho, Richi, Richi. Oange we mwaka la monge yewe mirembe, Tapukani, Katika Richi Mwecho, Richi. Mundo ko mwaka la monge yewe mirembe, Tapukani.
Ben awa munyanga mambo Murime umwe
Yes, that was our Saturday Music Spot, and I sincerely hope you enjoyed the music. And now the Saturday commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University here in Washington. Hello, Dr. Nyang.
Hello, Africa. It is always a pleasure for me to share my reflections about U.S. relations with Africa. Every passing week, I devote a great deal of my time looking at the headlines relating to African opinions on and attitudes towards the United States. And I also look at changing developments pertaining to America's diplomacy on the African continent. The issue of great importance to me right now relates to Africa's attempt to engage the United States in light of the invitation from President Obama. I have focused on the question of transparency and the manner in which transparency should be a big issue if there is going to be meaningful dialogue between the United States and Africa, because it involves the question of American assistance to Africa and the manner in which American assistance to Africa is affected by transparency in the public finances of these countries. Now, people have raised a lot of hell about corruption in many of these countries. But corruption is just one problem that is related to the whole question of human dignity, democratic process, and the development of a system of governance which allowed the Africans to take full control of their societies. Now, what complicates the African problem today is the fact that today you do have a large number of Africans in the United States who are citizens of this country. They came here during the Cold War, and they are now part of the American process. Secondly, you do have a large number of Africans in the United States who are green card holders. Then the number gets larger and larger as you add some of them who are just Africans living in the United States. So if you are talking about U.S. foreign policy towards Africa and the manner in which American policy affects the Africans in the diaspora on the one hand and the Africans on the continent on the other, U.S. policy towards Africa is directly directed to the Africans on the continent. And you do have a large number of African embassies. If you add Southern Sudan, you have almost 55 African states that are actively involved in D.C. So the State Department deals with all these African members of the African Union. So while we talk about preparing for the summit between President Obama and the African countries, a number of issues must be addressed. I have spoken about how American policy is going to be determined by American leaders develop strategies to engage the African leaders. Of course, there are infrastructural arrangements, there are people who are sufficiently engaged in this task. So when we have the summit in August, America is well prepared for that engagement. What I have been saying to the African side of the equation, how does African governments can begin to develop points of contact with the United States at a level where American policy towards the Africans will be more involving and more rewarding, because the Africans must be able to put forth a program that is going to change the day. There are a number of issues which are going to be critical as I look at the African-American relationship between now and others. First of all, the question of justice, equality, freedom in these African countries. When I say justice, I'm not saying justice coming from America telling the African leaders there must be justice, because in some of these African countries, the opposition groups have been agitating that they are not given all the rights to operate as political parties, or they are not able to really challenge the ruling party. There are different opinions about this matter across the continent. But the most important thing is, in order for American policy to be effective in Africa, the Africans on the continent must be willing to make a case for themselves. And this is the big challenge for the African governments individually and the African leaders collectively through the African Union. There has to be a new program of action between these African countries and the United States, because the summit is going to be meaningless if it is going to be one other summit, like we have Africans going to the Commonwealth and dealing with the British. And of course, they have collective and individual problems. You can do continental analysis, or you can do case-by-case analysis by looking at individual African countries. And of course, you're going to have an interesting report from country to country, from Angola, Algeria, all the way to Zimbabwe, the world and all the other countries in between. The big question, Hillary, is transparency is going to be the big issue, because if America is going to be fully involved in African development, the African leaders must come forth and tell the American people and their leaders, we want to really engage you. That's the way I see this story. And this is how I will conclude this analysis.
Thank you, Dr. Nyang.
Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America.
And from the rest of the Nightline team, we thank you for joining us tonight. I'm Douglas Mpoga.
And I'm Odette Frazier. Have a good evening.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On March 8th, many countries celebrated International Women's Day, honoring women and their achievements. Some countries, including the United States, have also set aside an entire month to celebrate women's history. On these occasions, we recognize the importance of women's empowerment and progress toward gender equality around the world. We also take time to recognize the many challenges that still remain. Women everywhere remain the backbone of their families, working daily inside and outside the home to keep their families afloat and their communities cohesive and thriving. Yet too many women's efforts remain outside the formal economy. Evidence has shown that when women entrepreneurs are empowered to join the public marketplace, they can make valuable contributions not just to their families, but to their communities and nations. This also holds true when women become involved in public decision-making processes, including conflict resolution. Yet women are too often underrepresented or even prevented from participating in efforts to rebuild post-conflict societies. Countries that value and empower women to participate fully in decision-making are more stable, prosperous, and secure. The opposite is also true. When women are excluded from negotiations, the peace that follows is more tenuous. Trust is eroded, and human rights and accountability are often ignored, wrote Secretary of State John Kerry in a recent article marking International Women's Day. The inclusion of women in peace building and conflict prevention can reverse that trend, wrote Secretary Kerry. Peace is not the absence of conflict. It is the presence of every member of society working together to promote stability and prosperity. No country can succeed unless every citizen is empowered to contribute to its future. And no peace can endure if women are not afforded a central role. So today and this Women's History Month, let us mark the miles women have traveled around the world. But more importantly, let us commit to the next miles of the journey.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.